Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome back to day two of our Standing Advisory Group meeting. We have another busy agenda today, so we'll get started right away. Yesterday was an excellent day. We appreciated all the input we received, and we received quite a bit, and we'll look forward to getting back to you on our comments and reaction to that input at our next sessions. So we had lively breakout groups yesterday. Tent cards weren't needed to be placed up, so it made the conversation even livelier. And we're now going to report back. The way we're going to do this is we're going to cover each topic, and we'll talk about the first topic, and then we'll ask for your input on that, and then we'll move to the second topic, et cetera. So I think, Jennifer, you're going to begin this with the consideration of the risk of material misstatement. And let me pass it along to you.
Before we do that, I know we have some SAG members on the phone, not sure exactly who's on. So if you could please, if you're participating by phone, just announce your name so we have a clear indication.
Hal Schroeder.
And Shelley Stein.
Okay, Hal and Shelley, thank you. And again, for both of you, if you have a comment when we start discussing, just indicate that you have a comment. We'll take note of that and call on you in order. So what I'll be talking about is there was three discussion topics yesterday, total of six questions. The first topic dealt with identifying, assessing risk of material misstatement, and really the main focus there was whether certain estimates or those with a wide range of measurement uncertainty should be, there should be a presumption that there's a fraud risk. And our group, which is Group B, spent a significant amount of time on that. And when Marty, Greg, and I were getting together last night and reviewing our comments, we recognized there was a lot of similarities among the three groups, and thought that each of us would talk about a specific individual topic, and then the other groups, well, kind of, they had some other things other groups will bring out, so they'll point those out. But to get us started, regarding the presumption of the fraud risk, there is consensus in our group that fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty have a higher degree of inherent risk. So we had acknowledgement about that. And the consensus that auditors should give those measurements additional audit attention. However, I think the group was pretty strong in feeling that those types of measurements should not be labeled as a fraud risk. There was concern that by doing a fraud risk, it may there may be other risks that auditors may not be focused on, and it's not the appropriate characterization. And labeling it as a fraud risk does not in and of itself guarantee an appropriate response. There was a consensus that if a presumption exists for fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty, then other accounting estimates with a high degree of uncertainty should also be a fraud risk. For example, loan loss estimates, environmental liabilities, litigation contingencies, et cetera. So the group acknowledged that there are certain estimates that carry a risk and should be given appropriate audit attention, but the group didn't feel that those should be labeled as a fraud risk. But there is this population of estimates that do carry higher risk. As far as audit procedures and what procedures should be performed on those type of estimates, the group felt that it's premature to mandate specific procedures because many of these are unique and carry different risks within themselves. So mandating specific procedures was difficult for the group to do. The group acknowledge that there's some procedures in ISA 540 which talk about estimation uncertainty, and some of those procedures may be appropriate. And we had one individual in our breakout group when we were talking about SAS 99 and the fraud risk presumption that's in our fraud standard right now and certain procedures that are outlined in that. And the individual pointed out when that fraud standard was developed, there was a wealth of information about frauds and revenue recognition and where, you know, fraud occurred by manipulating revenue. And so it was easier to tailor specific procedures for those type of risks, which were included in the fraud standard. But contrasting that with estimates and these different types of estimates, we don't have that wealth of information today, so it's premature to develop specific procedures. Regarding what this population of estimates with higher risk should be, our group did not spend a significant amount of time identifying those factors. We talked about level two, level three type assets, but in measurements that seem to have a higher risk, but we did not spend a significant amount of time focusing on exactly what the characteristics are, but there was certain recognition that certain estimates do carry higher risk. So that's a summary of our discussion. I'll turn it over to the other two breakout groups for additional commentary they have.
I'll start with Group A. With respect to the first question on the presumption, our group also agreed that it was not a fraud. This was not a fraud risk presumption. However, the group did we had a consensus that the presumption that a fair value measurement with a high degree of measurement uncertainty is a significant risk, and so our group agreed that it at least at that was at the significant risk level for the in looking at a high degree of material uncertainty, measurement uncertainty. Also, with respect to question two, our group came up with some possible procedures to recommend in this area. One being the auditor should evaluate the track record of management in making accurate estimates. Secondly, the auditor should evaluate the model if a model is being used and determine if the model is generally accepted. And thirdly, the auditor should consider alternative assumptions in place of management's assumptions and then use those alternative assumptions to calculate a point estimate in order to evaluate management's range of estimates. And then finally, the auditor should obtain third-party verification of the information. For example, the auditor should obtain an independent bid from a broker-dealer. With respect to the third question on the six factors that were outlined in the briefing paper, our group was of the opinion that that's a good starting point for evaluating whether fair value measurements have a high degree of measurement uncertainty, and we had no additional factors at that time to add to that list. Any other comments?
I would add on the factors that there was a suggestion that we looked at other standard setters for some additional factors that that some of the standards, I think it was the ASB draft standard, has some factors we might want to consider also.
For the third breakout session, consistent with the first two, overall there was a concern about presuming a fraud risk. However, there was overall a belief that there needs to be a higher level of skepticism for these fair value measurements that have a high degree of measurement uncertainty.
Comments from any of the groups, from the SAG members or and observers on this particular topic?
One of the facts that I'd like to point out is that it was mentioned that although fair values with a high degree of measurement uncertainty was a general consensus that it shouldn't be presumed to be a fraud risk, and the comment was made that it should be considered a significant risk. Significant risk is has been defined in AS7. And in our risk assessment standards, which were when they were exposed, as a risk that requires special attention by the auditor. So I think talking about these matters as significant risk does, in some sense, accomplish the same objective to some degree. And I think there wasn't anybody who doesn't agree that, at least in the group I was in, that these measurements by their nature, require special attention. It was the labeling of fraud risk that seemed to trouble most of the folks that were in the group that I was in, and I gather that was the consensus of the other groups. There was also, I think, a concern in the group that we were in that we had pointed out that if one looked over recent years and did an analysis of inspection findings in part one of all of the inspection reports, you'd see a good percentage of comments pertaining to the lack of professional skepticism around fair values. And that goes back to, you know, before there were inactive markets, comments pertaining to impairment assessment of goodwill and assessing the fair value of the goodwill. So it would go back a bit, and you'd see that fair values that have a high degree of measurement uncertainty, for instance, such as, you know, what's the valuation of goodwill, not just securities in inactive markets, do present audit challenges, and as I said, a fair degree of audit and inspection comments on that subject. So again, this will be continue to be high on our list in terms of it was mentioned yesterday that maybe there's a need for another alert. We'll consider that, and I think that may come up again with respect to some of the other items that we discussed in the breakout groups yesterday. But certainly in our revision, as we're working through the fair value standard, we will consider the fact of the number of deficiencies we find in this area. And the general view that this is an area that requires special attention by the auditor and how to get that. Again, can you call it? Arnold Schilder.
I noted that Jennifer quoted inherent risk, which as such was not mentioned in our group, but I think that's helpful. And your last comments, Marty, make me think of that at the IAASB, we recently have stepped up a liaison project with the IASB to comment only on auditability aspects of accounting standards. And this discussion also highlights, and it was mentioned in our group as well, that part of the uncertainty you cannot take away by whatever good audit you do. So that goes back indeed to the inherent nature and comments that may be fed back to accounting standard setters as well from an auditability perspective. So I think it's important to keep that in the context of the whole as well in mind.
Good. Those are good points. Thanks, Arnold. Others? Well, I think the lack of comment is, I think, consistent with the consensus that came from the three groups around these topics. So I think with that, why don't we move on to Brian. I think you're covering topic two, Brian Degano, and that was the evaluating the adequacy of fair value disclosures. Again, we made the point in the paper about the increasing amount of qualitative disclosures and the importance of those qualitative disclosures around fair values, and was there a need for additional guidance to auditors with respect to evaluating the adequacy of those additional disclosures?
Thanks, Marty. On balance, our breakout group noted that as footnote disclosures move further away from providing more detail of amounts that are already recognized in the financial statements, the process for collecting that information may not be as robust, and there could be room for improvements in those processes. And as a result, auditors probably could use more direction on evaluating the qualitative nature of disclosures. However, there was no clear solution on how to provide that additional direction. The group also noted that the issue does go beyond fair value measurement disclosures. The existing audit direction was created largely when footnotes were just a more detailed disclosure of amounts recognized in the financial statements. And if the FASB requires additional disclosures in the financial statements, those disclosures would be subject to internal control of financial reporting, and management would need to place controls and processes around those disclosures. In some cases, the preparers might focus largely on the point estimate being recognized in the financial statements, and the sensitivity analysis around that estimate may not receive as much attention, and that could place auditors in a challenging position to gather that information. As well, it was noted that an auditor could have a hard time winning an argument over the nature of a qualitative disclosure, as the decisions are very subjective.
I just add one or two comments on that from the room I was in with Brian, just to make sure everybody understood the point that was made. Gary Kaberuk, who's not here today, made the point that, and I think it's a good one, he also made it up at FASAC recently at a meeting I attended, that the nature of a lot of disclosures that are coming out of the FASB, and it's not only pertaining to fair value, but certainly in this area, some time ago, most disclosures in the footnotes really were derivatives, I don't want to use that word, really were derived from double entry bookkeeping in the general ledger. And they were just a further breakdown, if you will, of what was in the general ledger and numbers that were subjected to that kind of a systematic control. More of the disclosures now are outside of those processes, management determining other types of, you know, qualitative information around that that's not subject to the traditional types of controls. As that's being done, I think Gary even pointed out, you know, preparers probably have better processes and do a better job with respect to the disclosures that were the former than the processes with respect to the latter, i.e. those of the sensitivity analysis type of disclosures. So he saw it as certainly a risk from the preparer's perspective. I think, you know, there have to be internal controls over financial reporting around those types of, you know, type 2 disclosures as well. But if management is principally getting a value from a pricing service as to here's the estimate of the value of this complex security, a CDO squared, we think it's, you know, 65 cents on the dollar, it's pretty difficult then for the auditor to make a determination about, well, if those inputs change slightly, since maybe there isn't a lot of transparency around the inputs, if those inputs change slightly to another reasonable amount, what effect would that have on the financial statements? So it goes. So that's the challenge we're talking about here, and I think Greg Jonas made an important point yesterday. We were talking about it later in the day, Lynn and I, that, you know, evaluation of whether financial statements present fairly, maybe it's well understood with respect to the score sheet on what kind of P&L adjustments somebody has. Is it off by 2% or 3% net income? But in looking at qualitative disclosures and assessing whether or not all of the disclosures that should be there are there, and are those qualitative disclosures appropriate? Now, what's the standard for assessing presents fairly there? It's maybe not quite as clear as the math on the how far off is the P&L of the balance sheet. So, again, we had a lively discussion around that, not a particular answer, but that there are challenges here that we think we need to address, maybe not only with respect to these types of disclosures pertaining to fair value, but disclosures in general, when you get outside of the, you know, the typical and analytical details of general ledger breakdown. I see a couple of cards up, or at least one. Joe Carcello?
Marty, maybe I misunderstood you, but what I heard you say is that controls around the GL and kind of the accounting numbers in the typical corporation are likely better than controls around other, let's say, softer, more qualitative disclosures that are also required in the 10, in the K and the Q. If I understood you right, that may be true, but my read, and I'm not an attorney, so you might want to talk to some attorneys, but my read of 404A and 404B and my read of 302 would suggest that the Securities and Exchange Commission and Congress in the Act expect sufficient controls around anything that is required to be disclosed. That's the whole point of 302. It talks about disclosure controls and procedures. So I think to give the corporate community a pass on this would be a mistake.
I agree 100%. No disagreement that the controls have to, I think I mentioned that in my comments, that those qualitative controls are still subject to the internal controls of the financial reporting requirements. I think it was just observed, though, that the nature of the traditional inherent controls around things coming out of double entry bookkeeping are a little different than the qualitative controls, that the controls around qualitative subjective, you know, information, and it's more challenging. Maybe not that, obviously I was not making a comment that they're not there. I was commenting on the greater challenge in preparing those estimates, and therefore presumably a greater challenge on the part of the auditor in auditing those types of qualitative disclosures, which might indicate the need for more, and that's what we'll be thinking about in our project here, might indicate the need for more robust requirements in our as on our project on fair value auditing standard, although some of the people in the room that I was in would say they recognize the issue but don't need more prescriptive audit requirements around it. They think that the audit standards already require auditors to evaluate those disclosures. I don't know if any auditors want to comment on that point. Ted White?
We're here.
I didn't see you out there, Ted.
I'm hiding. Your qualifications notwithstanding, I agree with the difficulty in this area, but the main reason I wanted to say something is I would suggest that the PCOB put enormous amounts of emphasis on this area. From an end user's perspective, I think the quality of disclosures around fair value is just absolutely critical. There's too many complexities in this area. There are, you know, too many moving pieces in regards to the auditing standards that I think, frankly, most institutions, I'm sorry, the accounting standards that most institutions don't support at this point. And, you know, the quality of disclosures is the basis on which, you know, investors of various stripes can make all kinds of judgments in the quality of how fair value is done. And this is an area where the PCOB, I think, can help just immensely. So I would just place lots of emphasis on this.
Thanks for that point.
We haven't finished the summary from the other groups.
Right. Thanks for that point. I think some of the evidence we have in that area, the points we're just making, is probably based upon some anecdotal evidence from yesterday's discussions. As we go forward with this project, it would be important for us maybe to gather some more empirical evidence around the disclosures that are qualitative and the need for better auditing procedures around those than are there today or not. But if we take your point 100%, we think we should put enormous attention on that, and that's why we have this on our agenda. Jeff Mahoney?
I just wanted to second Ted's point that I think having robust disclosures in this area of fair value measurements, as well as in a number of other areas, impairments, loan loss reserves being two others, are a very important tool for investors to mitigate some of the issues raised by potentially inaccurate management estimates of fair value measures or these other areas of accounting which involve a significant amount of judgment and estimate. In the area of fair values, qualitative information is important surrounding how those estimates of fair value are done. Quantitative information is important about the valuation inputs, the sensitivities that you mentioned earlier. Quantitative information about unrealized gains and losses, other changes in the fair value positions, all of that is very important information to the investor community in looking and getting useful information from these fair value estimates. And again, I'll make another plug, as I did yesterday. There's a lot of discussion of this in the white paper that we issued last July that's available on our website. Another earlier point Joe mentioned with respect to qualitative disclosures versus quantitative disclosures, I would point out, and I think Peter could probably speak to this more than I can, but I know there's has been a number of times in recent years where the disclosures that the FASB has required, they received comments from the preparer community pointing to a preference of qualitative disclosures over quantitative disclosures. So to the extent that there is more qualitative disclosures now appearing in accounting standards, and part of that can be attributed to requests from the preparer community to have those disclosures rather than quantitative disclosures.
Good. Thanks, Jeff.